Well, thank you guys for that kind introduction, and congrats to Aaron. And it's delightful to be here. I hope you offer me the due amount of gratitude as a Duke guy for the fact that in this particular NCAA tournament, we decided that we had won too much, and so we kind of stepped aside a little bit. And, you know, Kentucky's my home state, so I was happy that UK won. I don't think we've quite decided whether or not we're going to let Kentucky have Shabazz Muhammad, but I'm told that we will find that out at 7:30, so, you know, we'll see if Coach K is in a generous mood then. It is especially fun to be back in the old stomping grounds of my dad. Al Cross was kind enough to take me over to the state capitol in Frankfort and show me the Louisville Courier-Journal Bureau and the old press facilities at the state capitol, and saw a picture of my dad who covered the capitol. And in those days, he was kind of a tough guy reporter, ex-Marine, Iwo Jima Marine. And his nickname, as Mitch McConnell once reminded me, because Mitch McConnell, I think, was a page in the Kentucky legislature when Dad was covering, was Black Death. As in, if you see Harwood coming, run away like it's the plague. Today, that would be a name for a cable show. And unfortunately, everybody's personality is their own, and nobody's ever going to call me Black Death. It just doesn't work for me. It is delightful to also just to get asked to speak at events like this, and I'm reminded every time it happens of how I started my career, and it's sort of a humbling memory. The first national campaign I covered was 1984. Ronald Reagan was running for re-election, and I was a young kid working for the St. Petersburg Times, and the White House put out a notice saying we're going to a black tie fundraiser in Beverly Hills, California, and you need to dress accordingly. Well, at that point in my life, I only owned one dark suit, so I packed the suit and tried to look as high class as possible. And we went to this fancy hotel where they were having the fundraiser. I was just blown away by the powerful people and the movie stars and the big shots and everything. And I was seriously put in my place when I went into the restroom at one point. And I was washing my hands, and I picked up a towel, to dry my hands. And right as I did, this very impressive-looking elderly gentleman in a tuxedo says, no, thank you. So I knew where I was on the totem pole at that point. Not offended by any of you guys using social media at this event. You might have just heard my BlackBerry buzzing. The things I carry around with me all the time, now that I have a career that spans television and newspapers, I don't even need a notebook all the time. I've got my iPhone and my BlackBerry always with me. I can tweet, I can write, I can file. And the other device that I carry with me is this custom earpiece so that I can clip it on the back of my jacket and be on TV from anywhere. Now, when I first got into television, everybody said, you need to have one of these custom earpieces made. And I kind of resisted. It seemed kind of diva-ish to get, your own, molded thing. And then I went into a studio one day at NBC and used one of the common earpieces that they had. And the producers of the show in New York kept trying to talk to me, and I couldn't hear anything. And the cameraman comes in from the other room, because it's an automated camera, and he says, wait, you're not responding to them. I said, I can't hear anything. I said, well, let me see if there's anything wrong with this. He says, oh, I know what happened. He squeezes the thing, and a bunch of other people's earwax come out of the thing. So that's when I said, I'm getting my own. And I have about 10 of them. So let me just talk a little bit about how I see the business of political journalism, my business, changing, why it's changed, and talk a little bit about that in the context of the 2012 campaign. And I think it's really a two-part story. One part of the story is about changes in business and the economic challenges facing the news business. And the other part of the story is political, about the ways that our political system has changed. Let me talk first about the way the political system has changed. I was born in 1956, right as Dwight Eisenhower was winning a second term as president. And at that time, as people in my generation or older remember or know, there were millions and millions of people in this country who were voting one way for president, another way for governor, senator, House of Representatives, state legislature. And that's because their partisan identifications did not reflect their ideologies, whether they were liberal or conservative, but really reflected the patterns established by the Civil War in terms of the Union, the Confederacy, and Republicans and Democrats. And we began, during the 1950s, a long process, accelerated by Vietnam, the civil rights movement, social change at home, of sorting out the parties in a way that was more coherent ideologically, so that instead of having a Democratic Party that was filled with white segregationist conservatives in the South and Northern liberals, union members, blacks, immigrants in the North, and a Republican Party that similarly mixed sort of progressive Rockefeller Republicans in the Northeast and a different kind of conservative in the Midwest and West, those all got sorted out. And now we have two very clearly and consistently and homogeneously liberal and conservative parties that take predictable stances on all the important social, foreign policy, economic issues of the day. And what we've seen now is that our media business, the political media business, has adapted to that change as a way of responding to the business pressures on the media. So when Fox News came out of nowhere during the 1990s and developed an identity as the network that was appealing and speaking to conservatives. And over time, it has become and is today the single best delivery vehicle for political messages for people trying to reach conservative Republican voters. It took a while to adapt, but other parts of the media have responded from the other end of the spectrum. So MSNBC, a network that I appear a lot on since I'm an employee of NBC, has moved very sharply in the same direction. And that's why a network that once billed itself as offering straight news, like CNN was doing, for example, has gone to appeal to liberals, progressives, Democrats in a very consistent way, which is why you have shows with Ed Schultz and Rachel Maddow and Lawrence O'Donnell and Keith Olbermann when he was there, Al Sharpton. So those changes in the political system have now come to be absorbed and reflected in the news media, especially cable TV, which has become quite important in our politics. The reason that the business pressures have been so great is all of the changes in media that slowly, over a long period of time, have eroded and destroyed the monopoly that small numbers of media organizations, newspapers, magazines, major broadcast networks, had on the delivery of information in this country. And, you know, we first thought that television was going to destroy newspapers, and then we thought that computers were going to destroy, or cable was going to destroy broadcast, and computers are going to and online and mobile devices are going to destroy cable. Well, all of that's happening, and the proliferation of media outlets has made it very, very difficult for media organizations to adapt their business model so they can continue to make money. Newspapers, I was talking to John Carroll earlier about the monopoly that newspapers once had in their communities so that they made tremendous margins of profit. Those are gone, and as a result, newspapers have gotten a lot smaller and circulations have and penetration rates have declined. So it is a struggle for anyone in the media business to make enough money to finance the dissemination and acquisition of information. I hosted a show on MSNBC for a couple of years called the New York Times Hour. We started it in 2008 and 2009. And the most important thing that occurs in that show or any other cable show every day is the next day at 5 o'clock when you get the ratings. and people, it is much, people used to say when I wrote for newspapers, which I still do, but less often, oh, you guys are just trying to sell papers. We never really felt that when I was at the St. Pete Times or the Wall Street Journal or now the New York Times. Didn't feel that very viscerally at all because of the monopoly power that we had. You feel it in television because when those numbers go down, and then they break it down to like every 15-minute segment, and what did we have on in that 15 minutes, and why did the numbers go down there? What were people clicking to at 6:15 as compared to 6:30? And it's very, very difficult for people to figure out how to adapt to those. And so we have a system now that has a set of pressures within it that I find uncomfortable, but we have to live with them. We value speed over accuracy and wisdom, or at least in relative terms, we value it more than we used to as compared to accuracy and wisdom. Just a tiny example. Every time there's a vote on a major piece of legislation in Congress, they will have, you can watch on C-SPAN, say in the House of Representatives, and they put the vote tally up. Or in the Senate, they don't put the vote tally up, but you hear the people calling the roll. They will want me to declare a bill passed while the vote's still going on once they get past 218 votes. And for a while, I tried to sort of hold out against this and say, well, it hasn't passed, the vote's still going on, people can change their votes. No, it's everybody's tweeting and, it's online, the thing's already passed. That just is an emblem of the kind of pressures that people feel to put stuff out before it's nearly as cooked as it was when I started in the business. And I think that is a challenge. I'll give you another small illustration. One of the first campaigns, second campaign I covered was 1988. Dukakis run against Bush, but it was an incredibly interesting campaign in both parties. You had Bob Dole and George H.W. Bush and Jesse Jackson and Gary Hart. And a guy named Richard Ben Kramer, I was riding on a bus with him in mid-1987, and he said, I'm working on a book. I said, great. This is one of the most talented journalists that I've ever known. I said, great, book on the campaign. Yeah, when's it going to come out? Well, I'm shooting for 1992. That was 5 years in advance of when his book was coming out. And I thought, you're crazy. How could you do a book? And he said, well, I just need the time. And he reported the hell out of that book, and he produced what I consider the greatest campaign book I've ever read. It's called What It Takes. Everybody should read that book if you care about political journalism and politics. The idea that anybody would spend 5 years on a book now is way out the window. Right now, my friend Mike Allen from Politico is, because news magazines barely exist anymore, they no longer have the project that we all became accustomed to, which was that just like Theodore White and other, the great chronicler of behind-the-scenes stuff in campaigns, Newsweek magazine had a tradition where they would put reporters behind the scenes with candidates and write a book like the next year with the understanding that all the stuff they saw couldn't be reported until afterwards. Well, now they're publishing e-books, Politico and Newsweek, in the middle of the campaign. So you forget 5 years, forget 1 year. Try 5 months, and they're writing books, and the books will come out at intervals every couple of months. I think that there's something lost in that, and I think it's unfortunate. But the speed with which this whole news process moves is just breathtaking. When my dad was covering the 1968 campaign, they would go out, and there are many times when they would go to campaign events that couldn't be reported for 24 hours because you couldn't get the information. They couldn't file the information by Western Union, given when they occurred. Midnight rallies, the television people couldn't get them. You didn't have ubiquitous live shots. We can go live from anywhere, and you can Skype with somebody from anywhere. We didn't have that now, so everything has to proceed at a much faster pace. And the most toxic of all, I think, though, is the tendency, the imperative, the felt need to push sensation and edge over analysis and reporting. And that's because edge gets more eyeballs on television. And that's why we have the cable networks that we have. I'll give you one small example of this that I thought was very unfair to Rick Santorum in the campaign that he has just finished. Rick Santorum gave a speech in which he was criticizing President Obama very aggressively over his energy and environmental policies. And he said that this is not science, it's theology or something like that. He said it's not Christian theology, but it's theology. And he was making the point that that the president and liberal Democrats had a near religious devotion to the issue of climate change, and therefore they were going too far. It was a point that I've heard Democrats make a million times about Republicans on taxes, it was sort of a religious tenet that taxes always need to go down. The little snippet of news that was reported instantaneously from Rick Santorum that said his theology is not a Christian theology was reported on the news as if Santorum was saying Obama was not a Christian. That's not what he was saying. And it was obvious to anyone who actually listened to the full text of what Santorum said. And I just think that's an example, one that victimized conservatives. And the same things happen to liberals and Obama and Democrats all the time on conservative outlets. And it's one of the reasons why this is the other big change that we've seen as a result of this sorting, is that campaigns manage themselves so that they only talk to those parts of the media spectrum that they think are going to advance their point of view, that will not have the snarky commentary right after it. And I think that that contributes to the situation, which is the most lamentable in my view, is that because audiences segment themselves by their ideology and their preconceived notions, because campaigns feed into that, give exclusives to their side respectively, that you have a situation developing where the common space that existed when I was growing up, the shared premises and assumptions of a political discussion, a shared acceptance of factual information, is very difficult to come by now. And so you have huge numbers of people in the country who don't believe Obama was born in the United States. Well, that's ridiculous. It's clear that he was born in the United States. And there is abundant evidence that that is true. But there are many people who don't believe it's true. And I think that is an illustration of the difficulty that we face of having a shared conversation that is meaningful and therefore that can move the society closer to resolving some of the problems that we have. And it puts more pressure on people like me who don't do opinion journalism to try to fight for the place in the conversation for fair-minded analysis of both sides. I will never have a cable show that is a left or right cable show. But what I hope to have a job in the business, but there's pressure on people who do what I do. Look at the ratings for CNN. They're terrible. Terrible. Because CNN uniquely, among the big cable networks, has held on to the identity as the straightforward deliverer of news. And they're under tremendous pressure to try to figure out how to make that work. Now, for all that, I do think there are some good signs out there and some encouraging signs. Most fundamentally, it's that the desire for information has not decreased. The amount of available information has not decreased. And the number of people who are gathering information to put out has increased tremendously. Twitter, all forms of social media have the effect of pumping things out into the national intellectual bloodstream instantaneously. And many of those bits of information, analysis, observation, do cross boundaries and do get exposed. You've also seen some people step into the void that has been produced by shrinking newspapers to get private financing I'm thinking of ProPublica, for example, which is a nonprofit entity that is partnering with many newspapers. It's won a Pulitzer Prize each of the last 2 years. We'll see if they win another one this year. For very ambitious works of investigation, explanation, analysis that are difficult to come by under the economics of our business right now. PolitiFact, service provided by my old newspaper, the St. Petersburg Times, also won a Pulitzer Prize for doing one of the most basic functions, which is so often lost in contemporary journalism, which is rigorously going over assertions that are made in the political dialogue and checking them. And the fact that they have been able to make a major impact with that, with what used to be called the, you know, truth check or ad box that we would do for campaigns, I think is pretty significant. And I would just finally say that it is also incumbent on all of us, you, my kids, the people that that they know, to demand and consume the kind of media that you want. You know, ultimately, as a society, we get what we deserve. And I think if the people who are following the 2012 campaign between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney and the ones that come after it are going to demand the kind of information that will enable them to make real distinctions and have real understanding of the political choices and the budget choices and the tax choices and the foreign policy choices that we face. Ultimately, we will find a way in the news business to profitably deliver that information. At least that's my hope. So with that as a stopping point, I'm open to your questions.
About shows like The Daily Show and the Colbert Report and what function they serve in this political landscape?
First of all, I love especially The Daily Show, but I like Colbert as well. I think they're very funny, first of all. But I think while being funny, they also communicate a point of view and a way of looking at political information that reaches a large number of people who would not otherwise get that information. So I think that makes a positive contribution. I know that the most feedback I've ever gotten from people under 30 years old has been from when I did both of those shows. And when I was interviewing Obama, you may remember the day that that a fly buzzed around his face and it landed on his hand and he killed the fly. And it became, the video of him killing that fly became the number one watched piece of video on YouTube for about 24 hours in the world. Stewart did a big thing on The Daily Show on that. Unfortunately for me, I couldn't get up to New York in time to play my part in the little skit, though he asked me to. But those kinds of things have tremendous buzz and relevance. So does Saturday Night Live. I take it back. It was The Daily Show wasn't the most feedback I've gotten. The most feedback I've gotten was when we had the CNBC debate in October, and I was questioning Rick Perry, the governor, and asking him which agencies he was going to eliminate from the federal government, and he said, well, you know, I'm going to be really tough because when I get there, three of them are going to be gone. And it's education and it's energy. And then he waits and Ron Paul's trying to help him out and Mitt Romney's trying to help him out. And people are laughing and Maria Bartiromo, my co-anchor, you're always uncomfortable on television with silence, and so we sort of figured, like, maybe we need to go on. And right as Maria started to ask the candidates a question about the deficit, this producer yelled in my little earpiece and said, stop, do not leave this topic. You've got to make him name that agency. So I asked him again, and he couldn't do it. And he finally says, oops. Okay, so that was Wednesday. Saturday Night Live opened their show with a skit in which they played me by name. And my daughter called me from Tulane, where she's a freshman with a room full of kids, and she's like screaming like, ah, the greatest thing in the world. Okay, so I don't think any of those kids, including my daughter, watched the debate when it happened, but they learned a little something about it. And so if you can do things that even in a small way, increase people's connection to the political process, I think it's a step forward.
I was wondering if you think that we'll ever get back to a true bipartisan journalism state, if entities like Fox News or NBC or MSNBC rather might ever get to a point where it's not just viewed as a leftist or rightist campaign, but more actual bipartisan journalism.
Well, I think there will be outlets that are bipartisan, nonpartisan journalism. I'm not sure that those particular entities, unless something happens that really discredits what they do and their point of view, I don't necessarily see them turning back in that direction. Could be surprised. It's not like I expected. If you'd told me 5 years ago that Al Sharpton would have a cable show on MSNBC, I would have led you out of your mind. So you can always be surprised. But I think other places will rise up to fill that space. And some people, I'm right now trying to start a show myself on politics and the economy. The challenge for me is to find sponsors willing to pay for that, because it would not rate well. We know that it wouldn't rate well. But if we can get it created, and if it produces a quality report helping people understand all the confusing information that they have to process about gas prices, the unemployment rate, the deficit, the trade deficit, where we headed with China, all of the things that are relevant to the standard of living that we have and that our kids will have. If we can find a way to deliver some quality added value, I just believe, and maybe it's naive, but I believe that will find an ultimately, that will find an audience, and the audience then will sustain the kind of journalism that you're talking about. That's my hope, anyway.
I wonder if you'd comment about the effect so far of the Supreme Court decision in the Citizens United case, which said, in essence, that corporations are people and can contribute unlimited amount of money, as well as what you think the effects might be in years to come.
Well, I have to say, I think the effects of that decision have been somewhat less than advertised in the following way. The key element of that ruling was declaring corporations as people and saying that corporations could spend unlimited money. We have seen these super PACs come to dominate the landscape in the Republican campaign, but the funding for those, at least from what we've learned so far, has come from wealthy individuals who already could do that and did do it in 2004, for example, the Swift Boat ads against John Kerry. So we will see when we get to the general election, and when, you know, it's easier to raise corporate money in some ways in a general election campaign if you're in an industry that clearly sides with one or the other. So will there be a lot of Hollywood money coming in for Democratic super PACs that haven't so far? Will there be a lot of oil company money coming in from Republicans, since the Democrats are running hard against the oil companies? We could see that, but we haven't seen it yet. We've seen the Koch brothers and Foster Freeze and Sheldon Adelson, the casino guy in Las Vegas, write huge checks, but they could do that before the decision. I do think that if we do see corporations get in a big way, and corporations, generally speaking, tend to be a little nervous about getting too heavily invested in politics, I think there's a possibility that you will see new attempts at legislation, but I'm not sure you're going to see that soon.
My question is kind of building off of the Rick Perry oops moment that you had with your producer in your ear telling you, wait, hold, press him on it. I wonder what the level of, I hesitate to use the word aggression when it comes to reporting because it brings to mind the Bill O'Reilly types.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm kind of wondering is, what about a building sort of a new brand of broadcast journalism where there is more of a direct approach in that regard, such as when in the Mitt Romney campaign where he says these incredible, fatuous lies and misrepresentations about the president's record, then where's the role for calling out these individuals when they say these things, or even having a mechanism of your own fact checkers to say, well, Governor, it seems that you have misstated this or something. I'm thinking of the many interns that ESPN commentators likely have feeding them their own ridiculous facts and figures that they say during a ball game.
Well, some of that is done through the fact-checking, the PolitiFact process, which has become copied to some degree by news outlets. In a direct way, directly to the candidate, opportunities to do that are somewhat limited because access is tightly controlled. This is one of the fundamental changes that has come to exist in campaigns compared to, say, when my dad covered them in the 1960s. They were with the candidate and their senior staff all the time. Press planes were smaller. Access was closer. They would go to dinner and drink together after the day's campaign events. We are kept at tremendous distance from these candidates in modern campaigns. So the opportunity to directly engage and get a response that's real and not just a talking point email, which is the routine way that campaigns respond now, is not easy. Now, I will say the one opportunity that we had, and the candidates came to hate these, is the debates. There were a lot of debates. And some of the very best debates and the toughest questions for these Republicans, in fact, came from my colleagues at Fox News because they felt the pressure when they had the access to the candidates for 2 hours, just like we did, to ask them something direct and intelligent. So they did get a bunch of those questions. Now, you can't make them answer them. You can only do your best to ask, and they don't like it. You know, some of the candidates did not like the questions that I was asking in our debate, which I tried to make as pointed and on target to the soft spots in their candidacies as I could. But now that debate season is over, those opportunities have become truncated. Of course you're going to get that from the other side. You get it from the other campaign. And you get it from websites and cable networks that tend to line up ideologically with those campaigns. But you also have a fact check process at some of the major newspapers, and less so on the broadcast networks because they don't have as much time for that. So I think it is done to some degree.
Thank you.
My question is about literary aspirations and literary possibilities for you and or for anyone who's covering the presidency. Number one, do you have literary as opposed to TV show aspirations? And number two, you mentioned the book What It Takes and what became of it compared to the making of the presidency. And when you set those two books in front of you, what does it say about our culture and our literary ability, our ability to read literature about the presidency and about campaigns? So there's two questions there. First, for you.
Let me just start with one general. There's a general problem that the book publishing industry has with the fact that people are reading fewer books than ever before, or it's more difficult to sell books than ever before, let's put it that way. alternative means of delivery, Kindle, the iPad, all those things, create opportunities in a new way. But that's a general challenge, and then that challenge is compounded in the political realm because so much information is available, offered, and consumed all through the process. So I think it's difficult to write a campaign book that has a lot of added value. I mean, I feel that as a reader, that I'm not terribly impressed by any or many of the campaign books that are done now, just because I live it all the time. Literary aspirations, you know, I think of myself as a reporter more than a writer. I did write a book with a colleague at the Wall Street Journal called Pennsylvania Avenue about contemporary Washington. It came out in 2008. I may do another book. If I do another book, one of the ideas that I'm playing with, it actually plays off of the arc of journalism as I've lived it through observing my dad's career and my own, is sort of a rise and fall of journalism book. He'd be rise, I'd be fall. But I will take more time to write that book if I do it than I did for Pennsylvania Avenue, which I did while working full time. And as for what making the president and what it takes says about our culture, I mean, I think what it takes was a real work of art. And Richard, who I know, has the torture scars on his brain to prove it, because it really was difficult for him to write that book. And I think it was genius what came out, and the sort of texture and depth and level of understanding and humanity that he had in that book, I think, to me, was superior to Teddy White. And I hope that we can get ourselves into a circumstance again where works like that would be produced.
I'm ceding my place because this is a follow-up.
John, I agree with you completely on what it takes. Mm-hmm. The greatest character study of politicians ever. It seems to me that during a campaign, what voters really need to know is not necessarily where people stand on issues. It's what's their character made up of, and what are the indications about how they will deal with issues that cannot be predicted. Isn't there some opportunity that is being passed up during these campaigns to really delve into people's character? I just don't see that much Richard Ben Kramer kind of reporting on these candidates.
Well, I think it's a question of how much of it there is, because there is some. Just a couple of observations, generally speaking, about the size of the press corps that we've got covering the race, which is much smaller than when I started covering campaigns, when you started covering campaigns. The Washington bureaus of major newspapers have been decimated. Some newspaper chains that had significant Washington bureaus have none now. Everywhere I go back to my old paper, the St. Pete Times, and talk to the edit page editor, who was a young guy with me when we started. And, you know, his predecessor had 14 people writing editorials. He has 5. That diminution has been reflected in state capitals and city halls all across the country. So I think the size of the teams has shrunk. But I do think that some teams, and I say with pride, the New York Times is foremost in my head among them, do still have the ability and the resources to do really searching stuff. I would recommend the long-run series that we have been doing, taking key moments in people's lives, not doing one profile, which is sort of a way that campaign journalism was done early in my career. You know, they would assign a feature writer to write the mega profile of a candidate. Those are a bit outdated because so much of that information is already known. But instead, some of the most talented reporters and writers have been looking at key moments in individual candidates' career. Mitt Romney's Mormon mission to France, or Rick Santorum's reaction to his defeat in as U.S. Senator in Pennsylvania in 2006. Barack Obama's time at Punahou, the private school that he went to in Hawaii. This was 4 years ago. I do think there is searching reporting that combines text, video, analysis, graphic presentation that is really spectacular in quality. So some of it's out there, not as much as is desirable, not as much as might have been produced with the size of the teams that we had before, but I do think it still exists.
I'm curious how you think issues of race and religion will play out in the reporting on this campaign, and I'll give a specific example. I believe in the last week, and I don't remember whether it was an AP story or CNN, but there was a story on Mitt Romney's problem with women, that women are not supporting him. And nowhere in that article was there a mention that it might have something to do with the Mormon Church's position on women outside the home. I had this conversation with some people when I was over in Africa recently, and we were speculating that race and religion may be two of the biggest issues in this campaign, and they will never get talked about. And I wonder how you think that's going to play out.
Well, I think you're right, but there's another layer to that, too, which is that there are some women who are resistant to Mitt Romney because he's a Mormon, but not because of the women outside the home aspect, but because the people who are uncomfortable are conservative Christians who think Mormonism is a cult. So that, you know, there was a lot of fairly facile analysis of during the campaign about how Rick Santorum was hurting himself in Republican primaries by statements that he was making reflecting the depth of his conservatism and how he felt about contraception and all that stuff. Yes, there are some moderate suburban Republican women who will be turned off by that. But he was winning the women's vote in a lot of the states which had high evangelical populations. And so, you know, the sometimes people forget, I think, how variegated the women's vote is, the men's vote is, whatever, the Latino vote is. But I do think that religion, both in some of the broad religious dimensions and the kind of stuff on the edge, that is going to be relevant. That is, there is a Mormon bias problem that Romney will face. Good news for him is that most of it, I think, is likely to occur in states that he's going to win anyway because they're the most conservative states. There will be people who vote against Obama because they think he's a Muslim. And, of course, there are going to be people who vote against Obama because of his race. But I do think that his election in 2008 stood for the proposition that the number of those people isn't that great, and I think it's probably smaller than it was 4 years ago, despite the sort of vitriol that we've had in our politics over the last few years. I think Obama is somebody who voters fundamentally like in a broad sense. They see him as a decent guy, good family man, and all that. You certainly have partisan polarization, but I think his likability numbers are pretty strong. But yes, I think Romney will do everything he can to go away from race. He doesn't want any stigma on that. And I don't expect the Democrats to be pushing the Mormon thing very strongly. But both of those are going to be factors in the campaign. Yes, because people don't want to put a foot wrong in talking about those things. This is one of the interesting things about cable. As much as cable likes edge, people say stuff and they get suspended, in ways that are somewhat surprising. And so I think everybody's self-filter gets pretty high when race and religion get discussed, and the people for whom it doesn't get high get in trouble. And it, of course, it's not just race and religion, it's other stuff too. I haven't seen what's happened to Ozzie Guillen, the manager of the Florida Marlins, but where he made some comments that he says were, mistranslated about Castro, and now there's like rampant speculation that he might lose his job. So.
Yeah.
Used to be with our network, exactly. Well, and that's a very interesting thing, because the things that Pat said in his book are not really different than things that he said, including said on MSNBC. But it is a reflection of how much MSNBC has adapted to the environment that I was describing, that once it codified in a new book and a publicity tour, and the audiences of that have become accustomed to a certain point of view from MSNBC don't want to hear that. And so they fired him. You can fire somebody for, if you're in the communications business and you don't like what people are communicating, fine, you can fire them. But he's not communicating anything differently than he has for the 10 previous years that he was working for MSNBC.
I actually had another question. It's kind of a two-parter. How do you think that social media will affect this election, and how do you think that social media will affect the way people report it?
Well, I think social media, first of all, on the reporting side, it's become a tool for people trying to gather information, both Twitter, Facebook, and I don't really know what Pinterest is, but I'm sure that will become used by reporters as well, as much as my daughters talk about it. I think social media will be most relevant to this campaign by virtue of the skill that the candidates show in using it to galvanize their vote. I believe the analysis that's been done suggests that social media are more Democrat friendly, and you're more likely to be able to communicate with Democratic leading voters that way than with Republicans. Certainly we saw in 2004 with Howard Dean a real breakthrough, a jump up in terms of the use for fundraising, as well as for crowd building, as well as for list building by campaigns. And that was taken to new levels by the Obama campaign in 2008. And they are facing the challenge they have right now of trying to recreate some of the magic that Obama had in 2008, which doesn't exist in the same way after you've been president and made a bunch of people unhappy, disappointed during that time. They are using that, I think, harder than ever to try to gin up and revive some of that enthusiasm using very sophisticated software that looks at where people are consuming information, what they're clicking on, and all that. So if we have a very close election, which there's good reason to think we will, that could make a difference on the margins.
And what dangers do you think there is in reporters and journalists using social media as a tool in the election? I read a case, I don't remember who it was, in this past week where there was something that went completely out of control. I think she was a chief of state. Somebody took that source from a blog and then tweeted it, and it went everywhere. And it ended up on Huffington Post and NBC and things like that. Do you think that there's a danger in using social media as a tool, as a source, as opposed to having the traditional check with your sources when social media can be such an immediate tool?
Yes. I don't think that danger is created by social media itself, although social media becomes another reflection of it. The danger is the need for speed. And so many things get reported before they're done. And social media encourages that predisposition, because once something's out on Twitter, I hear from my desk, my CNBC desk, continuously. And one of the things that, like, here's a reflection of that. Stuff gets out on Twitter and or Drudge or some other HuffPost or some other website. Immediately, news desks all around the country will then call reporters and say, can you confirm that? And first of all, there's pressure on people to confirm it. And so unless they're secure in what they're doing, you may have some people who are tempted to shortcut that process of confirmation. And it just becomes to the extent the information may be bogus, and oftentimes it is, it becomes a a real sort of time suck for everybody involved that is unproductive and doesn't advance the cause of journalism or politics, for that matter. And you know, there was a lot of time spent knocking down rumors in the 2008 campaign, and there's a lot of time spent doing that now. Some of it's just the normal process of journalism, but I think there's more of it because of the speed with which social media puts stuff out there. And the one other thing about social media I think is important is that, you know, I think it's very important for journalists to be transparent and honest about what they're doing. And so I am aware of some cases where people, reporters, have gone on to social media without disclosing who they were and what they were doing to try to get information. And I think that, I think there's a danger there. And if you start blurring the obligation that journalists have to be upfront about what they're doing, that bothers me. And I hope we can prevent that from going too far.
How do you explain Ron Paul? And what I mean is my 16-year-old gets a car for, you know, his first time, and he gets a bumper sticker and says Ron Paul. Mm-hmm. And so for young voters, it really seems like the enthusiasm is there with this old guy, you know? And one, because we almost went through another venue without mentioning him at all, which, you know, your political reporters, I just want to say, you know, if I were a campaign manager, I'd be going ballistic every time. He's just totally dismissed. And then if that's not enough of a question for you, how do you explain Newt Gingrich?
Well, first on Ron Paul. Ron Paul has a bracing point of view that stands out, that in some ways challenges both parties, that seems like a straight talk set of proposals. People don't like them, will say he's a crank. But he doesn't duck the implications of his positions, and he's candid about them. And I think there's something very appealing to that, about that, and non-political seeming about that to young people. And I've experienced the phenomenon of young people being galvanized by Paul. But I also think you have to look at the primary results and realize that, yes, there is something there, but it's not that big of a something. There is a libertarian niche remaining within the Republican Party that is significant, measurable, makes an impact, but isn't that big. And that's why Ron Paul is a non-factor in the nomination race. As far as Gingrich goes, Gingrich has surprised me by his decision to run in the first place. But he was drawing on, in a season when Republicans and conservatives were not happy with Romney, were feeling that Romney wasn't one of them. For all of the setbacks that Gingrich has had, all of the flaws in his persona, he has some authentic sort of shared blood with the modern conservative movement by having broken the Democrats' 40-year hold on the House and leading this Republican revolution. So that there's still some magic in that. It was discredited. He suffered a bunch of setbacks. He made a bunch of mistakes. He made a bunch of enemies. We saw that when he rose up and did well in South Carolina and did well in the polls at an earlier point in the process. But ultimately, the flaws became too much, and he simply didn't have. He is the ultimate solo operator in politics, at least at this stage in his career, and you can't really run a successful campaign on that. Too many targets for a better funded, better organized campaign once he rose up, and that's what happened.
Okay.